Good evening, ladies. It's so nice to be learning again after a little bit of a break. We are going to be starting a completely new section. This is now, we're going to be doing what is the series called The Quest for the Crown, which is these five parakim, which are now from Perek Ches to Perek Yud Beis in Sefer Shmuel Aleph. This is quite a momentous period and occasion in Shmuel itself. And here's how we're going to do this. So first of all, just the new way of doing things is we're going to do like a booklet. So on the left-hand side, there's going to be text, which is just like the psukim themselves. You're welcome to have your own Tanakh as well, but if you want the space for notes on the left. And then on the right, every week, we're going to do a different section. We're going to have extra packets. So this week, for instance, we have the first one. The first part is called The Request for the King. We're going to spend our time today going through Perek Ches itself. Once we've mastered the text, then next week in Metzah Hashem, we'll have the opportunity of actually dealing with the issues. Okay, so that's what we're going to do. We're going to generally speaking, I'm going to do the text first, and then we're going to like sort of reflect in between different parakim as well. Okay. So here we go. Let's without much further ado, let's start. And remembering, we're also going to stop a little bit early today because there's an 8:30 Jewish history lecture by Dr. Abramson. Today is the third and last of the lecture, which is going to be on Rav Kook, which promises to be fascinating as always. So let's start. This section in Tanakh is going to be one of the ones with a huge amount of psychology, a lot of societal anthropology in terms of the development of society to its next stage. There's so much for us to delve into, to appreciate. So let's start at the very beginning. Let's try to start with a fresh mind because we do have preconceived notions, but it's important to jump in and appreciate this on its own ground. So let's start. Perek Ches in Shmuel. Let's remind ourselves what has just happened, just to make sure we're jumping off on the right part. Okay, so what happened is the ark has returned from its exile, and Shmuel has resided as now the judge. We left on a very good note. Shmuel has returned the glory. Everything's good. So that's kind of where we are from, without going into much further detail. On that note, here are the psukim, which are kind of very disappointing to us. Here we go. In Ches Aleph to Gimel, the psukim tell us the following. Vayhi kasher zaken Shmuel, when Shmuel became old, Vayosem es bonov shoftim liYisrael. He made his son judges on Israel. So he appointed his own sons in his stead. Vayhi shem benoy habachor Yoel, v'shem mishneu Aviyah, shoiter shoftim biver sheva. So his children's names were Yoel and Aviyah, and they were judges in Be'er Sheva. V'loy holchu bonov bidrachov. They did not walk in his ways. Vayitu achar abotza. They went after, literally that means bribery or money. There's the bribery, Vayatu Mishpat, and they perverted justice. So that's kind of the end beginning of Shmuel's lifespan, which is a very disappointing way to be ending, because one of the big problems that I've experienced for many, many years in Tanakh, and I'm sure you've also felt this as well, is where did all the good times go? You know, you read Torah, and there's so many wonderful things that happen, but they happen like one, two, psukim, and then all the bad stuff, the complaints and the problems go on for pasuk after pasuk and parasha after parasha, and the punishments which are meted out and meted out again. You kind of, it's a very depressing kind of feel at the end of things. So yeah, we have Shmuel, and then we have this, you know, suddenly he's old and his children not in his ways. Just to actually clarify, anybody aware of how long Shmuel was actually in power before without a gasping for fresh air, we're already talking about how he's grown old now. How long did he actually rule? Any guesses? 16? 40? Okay, 40 is actually a pretty good guess because 40 was a magic number in Sefer Shoftim, and that was like the sound of a very good rule was 40 years. Let's work backwards. This is what Rashi does at the very beginning of Sefer Shoftim. I didn't put in the notes, but in Perek Aleph, towards the end, Rashi says the following. So he says, let's work out the cheshbon. When we were doing this Rashi at the beginning, we couldn't really appreciate all the numbers because we didn't have the numbers. But here's how he goes. This is the clues the psukim tell us. We know that Shmuel HaNavi lives 52 years. Okay? That's important, just by the way, because remember that Shmuel lives 52 years and he is a Levi. And interestingly enough, a Levi's service is for how long? A Levi's age of service is till 50 years old. Why is it 2 extra years? Because he didn't start right away. Because when he was born, his mother weaned him first. In the age of 2, she brought him into the Migdash, and he so to speak, his life was metaphorically those 50 years unknown to God, to Hashem, so to speak. That's the way he lived. So now, if we know that Shmuel's 52 years old, so at the time that he passes away. So now let's do the math. We also know that when did Shmuel take power? When did Shmuel become the judge? When?
After the battle,
because Eli dies, and that's when Shmuel takes power and he sort of rallies everybody together and fights against the Philistines. Great. So we have the time when Eli dies. So here's how it works. We also know that from the time that Eli died, the Aaron was in a place called Kiryas Yearim, which we met last time, for 20 years. The Psukim last Perek said they were there for 20 years. The Aaron is there from exile till redemption, real redemption, meaning Kiryas Yearim is in a place in Israel, but it wasn't brought to the Mishkan. There was no Mishkan, there was no Beis HaMikdash yet, until the times David redeemed it. Okay, so it was a 20-year gap. So how many of those years belong to David? How many of those years belong to Shaul HaMelech? So we know that David redeemed the Aaron, or took the Aaron from Kiryas Yearim and made it a place in his own area. He did that when he had become Melech al-Kol Yisrael, when he became a king of all Israel, which we'll see, God willing, soon. That occurred when David HaMelech got unanimous acceptance as king. Happens to be that David HaMelech didn't have unanimous acceptance as king at the beginning. He had 7 years where he was king over the south, and then he became unanimously accepted. So seven years David was ruling before he managed to get the Aaron out of Kiryas Yearim. So of those 20 years, we have 13 of them which weren't with David. Then we also know that that Shaul and Shmuel die around the same time. How long did Shaul HaMelech reign? This is a bit of an astounding one. He only reigned for 3 years. Okay, so Shaul HaMelech only reigned for 3 years. So the way that Rashi works it out over there is he says, if we take away those the times of the three years of Shaul HaMelech and the 7 years of David HaMelech, and we know that it was in Kiryas Yearim for 20 years, what we have over here is there should be 13 years that Shmuel was ruling. 10 of them were where he was ruling full. Then the last 3 of his years where Shaul HaMelech was alongside him. And then he and Shaul die and David HaMelech takes over for the next 7 years. So, interesting enough, just in the span of time that Rashi has it, we have a bit of 13 years, what we call 10 full power, 3, we'll call divided power. But Shmuel does have a very good run. Okay, so he has a lot of good times, but Tanakh doesn't talk about it. Okay, so Tanakh isn't focusing on that. You have to question yourself, so why? Why the downer? Why don't we focus on the good parts? So, there's a shir that Rad Foreman once gave, and I thought it was just a really interesting point. He quotes a book called written by Mortimer Adler, and the book is How to Read a Book. In order to read a book, you need to know the tools of reading a book, if there's a book that's really worthwhile reading. So I got the book, and it's actually a very interesting book, an academic work. And one of the things that he says is before you read a book, you need to understand what the point of the book is, right? Because otherwise you're going to ask the wrong questions about that book. So the examples given would be like, let's say you are reading a chemistry textbook and you think that it's a poetry textbook. So you're going to ask the wrong questions. If you think it's a poetry textbook and you think that it's really a physics textbook, you're going to ask the wrong questions about the poetry. Poetry is not literal. Poetry is not trying to tell you very specific and finite dimensions of things. It's trying to give you ideas, abstract understanding and knowledge. So when we deal with Tanakh, what is Tanakh's point? What is Tanakh trying to do for us that we should that we can understand why it is here? So what would you say? What would be the point of Tanakh if we want to try to understand what's going on over here? Why are we not told about these good times? What's the most obvious shot you'd say with Tanakh?
Teach us lessons of behavior.
Okay, so lessons of behavior, that's a very strong one. What else do we have? Jenny.
You might want something that's going to last through the generations.
Okay, so that's more of a thought. You're sort of looking at it from the side. I'm asking, what's it actually doing? Right? You're telling me an element about it. Well, what is it doing itself? I mean, what's its point? So can you tell us your lessons? Some people say, well, it might be history, right? So it gives us Jewish history, right? So the reason why it can't be history is because it doesn't tell us all of history. Like, yeah, here's an example. There were 13 or 10 good years. We know nothing about them, right? We only know about the in-betweens, which are much more difficult. So you say, well, maybe it's laws. There's lots of laws, but the problem is, there are lots of stories. Right? And it can't be a storybook because there's too many laws. Right? So what is it? So the argument that Foreman makes, which I think is very worthwhile, if you have a chance to take a look at this, it's a Parshas Noach video from 3 years ago. Very fascinating argument is that this is a book, similar to what Auden was saying, is that it's a book, a guidebook. It's meant to guide us, and with Shelley's properties, which is, it's meant to guide us at all times. So therefore, if the point of it is to guide us, and us means to say us 2016, not just us living in the Iron Age in Canaan, right? So in Israel. So therefore, it has to have resonance to us right now. So obviously what happened during the good years of Shmuel isn't relevant to us right now, meaning it was wonderful and they had a heyday. Everything was fabulous. But that wasn't relevant for the lessons we're supposed to learn. Where the lessons pick up again? When we find out about the next stage. Okay, so where things went south a little bit. That's where it's important to us. So just as important in terms of we shouldn't be thinking that Tanakh has always got a pessimistic, half-empty kind of perspective on life. Rather, what's actually happening in Tanakh over here is Tanakh is casting for us the parts of the story that we need to know to be able to reflect. If that's true, then that means just at the end of every year we should be thinking, what is it today that we actually gained? Okay, so that's our responsibility then, is to say, okay, so what about this was necessary that wasn't necessary about those 10 good years? Okay, so that's our goal going forward. So, on that note, what do you think it means? You know, Shmuel HaNavi was a fantastic leader. He was a leader that Sheim Kamoyo, there's very few people like him up to now. So what does it mean is that his sons weren't going in his ways? That's rather disappointing. What happened? They missed the memo? Okay, so you know, so what some people could say is that, you know, as the Radak will say, Kipshuta, it means to say, look, they didn't get the memo. Why? We could pontificate, we could say that maybe it was, the Tanakh doesn't tell us, but it could be that, you know, leaders spend a lot of time with their flocks, and that means to say that's the exclusion of other people, right? So Shmuel was spent a lot of time outside of the house, so maybe he wasn't there, we don't know. But that's definitely a possibility. You know, Moshe Rabbeinu as well. You know, when we look at Moshe Rabbeinu's children, that we don't know so much about them. And in fact, the little bit we do know, there's a little bit of negativity, actually, we saw with Menashe, who's his grandson, who turns out to be it is Moshe Gershon, Gershon's son, who is Yonatan, who is not such a savory fellow, at least at the beginning of his life, as a priest to Avodah Zarah. So, you know, this happens. That's number one.
However,
what's interesting is what you're pointing out, Autumn, is that there's a pattern going on over here. We had just before, and another Shofate, who was also really a pristine leader. He had some flaws, as we saw them, but his sons really went completely amok, right? So that was really a sad chain of events. It's almost like the pattern's mirroring itself. In fact, if we look out through the rest of Shmuel, let's sort of put this on the big notice board behind us that we keep in the back of our minds. Let's look for continuity over here. You know, we have Eli, doesn't make it, children go off the way. Shmuel, children don't make it. Then we're going to see Solomon. After his children make it, some of them are killed. We're going to see that Shaul's children don't really make it. It seems that there's always going to be a surrogate son to every leader. And the surrogate son will take the leadership. It's going to be interesting, right? So Shmuel becomes a surrogate son of Eli, and his surrogate son is going to end up being Shaul, because not his own children. We're going to see this movement throughout, say, for Shmuel, of lack of continuation, which is a bit of a sad point over here. Helene. Yes, absolutely.
Right. One
yes.
Was good, one wasn't.
Yeah. Well, you can even see you, if you want to be if you want to go further, you know, if you think about somehow, is if you want to think about what the Akedah really means in that direction as well, the Akedah is almost Hashem saying, whose son is this boy? Mm. Yours or mine? Right. I mean, you should say like, whose son is really here? Who's yours? There's the question of real, who's the real father and who's the real son in a lot of these questions over here. So this goes into a lot of, as you're right, with the sort of the culling down of we're getting to the Shiftei Kar. But now, let's get there actually happens to be, there's a more of a subtle reading of this. So the more of a subtle reading is that when it says that they didn't go in his ways, maybe ways means a little more subtle than we expected. It maybe means to say literally the ways, the actual paths that he walked in. Now, what paths did Shmuel walk in?
Was a Nazir.
Shmuel was a Nazir, so he wasn't that, but there was also something else. Where does Shmuel physically walk? We know about him that he had a very unique way of being a leader. How did he do it? He went to the people, okay? So he didn't set up shop and have everybody come in and have office hours and you could sign in online and you could get it early in the morning, was usually better. He didn't have that kind of system going. He went and it says at the end of the last paragraph that he would go round and round and round. Ramah was sort of his base, but he would spiral out to all of Israel and visit them on their terms. So when it says that they lo halchu bedrachav, they didn't go in his ways, maybe it doesn't mean to say that they were off the derech, so to speak, you know, the abstract derech, you know, that Shmuel was in. Maybe it's just saying to say that they had a different methodology of leadership. Where were they? So the Pesukim actually tell us. They were shoftim where? Biv'er sheva. So what did they do? They set up shop. They opened up office hours. They said, if you'd like to consult us, come by. Stop by for coffee. Then we'll speak to you. And apparently, even that was considered negative. Right? Meaning to say the subtlety over here, what the Radak, what the Malbim, what the Mefarshim say is that even that was subtly wrong. Why? Because if you let's think about this for a moment. Shmuel HaMelech served the community selflessly. Shmuel HaNavi served the community selflessly. He was out there, he was on the ground, wherever there was a need, he addressed it. He didn't wait for people to decide to find him if there was a problem. He was there when the issues were happening. His children got comfortable. They settled down. Not only did they settle down, where is Be'er Sheva in terms of geography?
South.
In fact, in those days, they did not have Eilat. They did not have the southern reaches. They'd, I don't know where they went for resorts, but in the end of the day, the Be'er Sheva was the southmost part of Israel. If you lived in Dan, which is up in Lebanon right now, and you needed a shofet, what would you do? You understand what's happening over here? Is there's a problem being created in the way that it's being that they are strategizing their leadership, and apparently that was a criticism. In addressing this approach, the one problem that we can have in the Pesukim is that it says that they went after money as well. So where's the money in this? Meaning, if it's all about subtlety, where's the money? So what the Mefarshim say, we're not going to read it inside, but the Radak says is that it's much more financially stable to have your own place. And people pay, and then you get an attendant. There's going to be an administrative office at the beginning, and she signs everything in. And there's going to be a man who's going to be in charge of making sure there's follow up, whatever else it is. You're going to have a whole staff, right? So they went with the more comfortable route of working with people. But so the Tanakh is criticizing him and saying that even that comfort was a bit of a shochad, was a little bit of a bribe to them. They were taken in by the comfort of serving the society, and that wasn't the way that they should be doing it. So whichever way, whether it means as sort of, you know, basically expressed, which is that they really went off the derech, or they just went off the derech of Shmuel, nonetheless, they weren't on the same tier as him. And whichever way is a disappointment, however egregious, whichever direction we're going. Helene, you had a thought?
Yeah, because the next passage clearly says that they took bribes and they were perverted justice, so they didn't go in any way like their father.
Okay, so that was what I was just saying. At the end, the Radak and the Ramalbim would say that the money that's talked about over there is not bribes, as they have people slipping money to them under the table, but rather that the comfort of the situation of not having to go further was something which appealed to them so much so that they kind of were comfortable. They said, let's, you know, we don't need to go anywhere. It's too much.
But what about perverted justice?
Oh, so in that direction. If I'm not mistaken, I just want to double check over here, but the way that he understands it, the way that Radak would understand it is that there may, I don't know if he says this, but the way that I'm interpreting it is that there would be people who would not get the right justice because they didn't have access, they weren't willing to go to that to those lengths. That's the way I would take it. So I mean to say, you know, there's a lot of debates about these things. How accessible do you make, you know, halachic psak to people? You know, how many people do you allow in to the fold of giving psak, not just opening up a book and reading a shayla, but really giving psak? And the more you democratize it, on the one hand, you allow more people access. There's a lot of statistical analysis which has been done about what happens if there's only a few people and the amount of questions which aren't asked because there's less people to ask questions from. So, and in those queer cases, what happens? People are machmir, people are mekel, right? And both are destructive. When people mekel shalom unnecessarily, or machmir shalom unnecessarily. So this is part of what I think is being described over here. Be it as it may, so this is the situation. Unfortunately, this leads to a very uncomfortable confrontation. Here's the confrontation. Dalet zuches. Vayizkabzu kol zignei Yisrael vayavo el Shmuel haramasa. So everybody comes to Shmuel and led by, interestingly enough, the Zakenim. They're led by the elders themselves. And they said to him, Hine ato zakanta. Look, Shmuel, they're not beating around the bush here. Shmuel, you've grown old. Your sons are not walking in your ways. Okay? Egregiously or more subtly. Simu lanu melech l'shavtenu kechol ha'goyim. Look, we have a great solution. You make us a king like all the rest of the nations, and he will judge us. Vayira hadavar b'nei Shmuel, kasher amru tznanu n'melech, l'shavtenu v'yispalel Shmuel al Hashem. Shmuel did not like this idea, and he prayed to Hashem. What we're going to do, just to put this on hold in this respect, is we're going to deal with next week what was really wrong with this. Okay? Because after all, it is a mitzvah in the Torah to anoint a king. And the mitzvah is, in fact, couched in almost the exact same terms as the way they request it. So we're going to have to deal with that throughout the ages of what the problem was. But we're not going to deal with that right now. What I would like to point out is an interesting thing. Is that if we go back to Sefer Shoftim for a brief moment. Shoftim, what was sort of the general failing of Sefer Shoftim? Okay, so there was no melech in Israel. So what was the problem of not having a melech? What's the issue that's created by not having a melech? What was that? So meaning to say, okay, so we had this form of anarchy developing, but we had shoftim. What's the meaning? Why is the shofet temporary?
Because after the problem was solved, he went away.
Okay, so another way of saying he went away is he died. Right. So at the end of the shofet's life, okay, so that's how my son describes. He comes back from kindergarten. He talks about the donkey, the chicken, and the lamb that Rabbi Akiva had, and then the lion took away the donkey, and the cat took away the chicken, you know. So when the shofet would die, there was no continuation, right? Because in the end of the day, what ends up happening is there was a great period of restitution, and we're back to our golden age, and then it disappears, gone, finished when he's dead. So part of the problem of shoftim was the anarchy which developed, but when did it develop? In the gaps, the anarchy developed in the times when there was no dynasty, essentially, and in fact all the way through Shoftim that was the problem. There was one exception. We're going to deal with that a little bit. There was one person who almost anointed his children. Anybody remember?
Gidon.
There was a person called Gidon, and everybody said, "We want you to be a melech," and he did in fact his children did rule after him. His son was not such a good fellow, Avimelech, what ended up happening was. Is now you have a time where suddenly we start seeing the beginning of Sefer Shmuel, the children do start featuring. You know, Eliezer, Hophni, and Pinchas could have maybe, but then they didn't. Right? They kind of went in the wrong direction. But they were kind of the heir to Eli's position. And then we have Shmuel, and his children are like, and they're not really going in that direction, right? So what do Israel come and they say? They come and they say, let's get a king. What's in response to what? In response to the fact that? There's a gap coming, right? There's a gap coming. When Shmuel dies, children not good. What's going to happen? What's going to lead on now? So it sounds, meaning you would think, this is the right moment. Right, they're getting there. They're sorting out the future before they have to deal with it. They're buying the insurance before the insurance is needed. Right, so you think this is great, but Shmuel doesn't think it's so great as well. So we're going to have to sort of see what it is that Shmuel really bothers Shmuel over here. Why is he davening, by the way? Why do you why would you daven in this circumstance? Eri's got this discussion. Why is he turned to Hashem? Is that what you would have done at the end of this conversation? What could he be trying to be evoking? What?
Then maybe his voice should go in the right direction.
Okay, so voice to
he wants his sons to be.
Okay, maybe he's praying for his sons. Could he? Very possibly. It could also be that, you know, Shmuel over here, this is probably one of the most critical conversations he's going to have in his career right now. He's done lots of very important leadership. But this conversation is going to really set the compass for future leadership. So he wants to make sure he's going to say the right thing. Right? So he turns to Hashem and says, Hashem, I don't know what to say to these people. Right? I never expected that I'd give a knock on my day and after these 10 years of serving them night and day, week in, week out, month in, month out, suddenly they're telling me that, you know, that it's time for retirement. So he doesn't know what to do. So he turns to Hashem. Is it there?
Something doesn't make sense, though, because like they want a king because the reason there are gaps is because they're not continuity.
Right.
So, but every time they have the children taking over, it doesn't seem to work out.
Doesn't seem to work out either, right.
So it's like they're asking for something which they already know doesn't work anyway.
You're right. So it's such a good big problem. We're going to have to see as well. As we're going to see, there is no perfect system. Right? If you found it, publicize it quickly, because we're still struggling. But we're going to see that, yes. And the blindsidedness over here, we're going to see in just a moment, of how Israel perhaps are willingly blindsided by the magical grass on the other side, which looks a whole lot greener. Yeah, Karen.
Okay, I think what they needed was a woman's help in this situation, because it's staring us right in the face. What he needed was to be a better parent to his children and tell them, listen, this is the way I want you to do things. Stop, you can't settle in Beersheba. You have to do things the way I'm doing.
Right.
He needed to tell them what to do, for God's sakes. Sometimes our kids need to be told what to do.
You're right. So, Karen, I would...
we don't know if we don't tell them.
So, Karen, unless you have the magic bullet that you're willing to share with all of us...
I didn't say they always listen. I'm saying you have to try.
I have no doubt that Shmuel tried very hard, but... There's this thing about these kids, and that they just don't seem to see the world the same way as you until they grow as old as you, and then by that time it's too late to do the same thing they would have done as you, which is one of these big problems that experience only comes with after youth. And so, but you're right. So I would imagine that Shmuel did the very best he possibly could, but he's still facing a very difficult reality. So you know, it is a very difficult situation. What does he do? So he has to listen to the interesting methodology. What happens now? This is very radical, almost. Hashem says to him, in Ches, we're doing Perek Zion to test for a moment. Hashem says, play the bluff. Give them the king they ask for. They're not despising me. You, they're despising me. So now, this we're going to have to get into next week, is what the real issue is here in this request. Just as the same way they left me behind after I took them out of Egypt and did everything for them, they're doing the same thing to you now. Look, this is how Israel does things. Listen to them. But tell them exactly what kings do. Okay, so Hashem says, give it to them, but tell them what kings do. So listen to what Shmuel says. Shmuel's now going to tell them, this section in Tanakh is called the Mishpat HaMelech, the law of the king. Now I want to sort of play a little bit of a game. As we read through this psukim, think to yourself, is this the legal right of the king, or is this the illegal right of the king? Okay, is this something a king should be doing, could be doing, should not be doing? What Shmuel HaMelech is trying to describe to them. So let's read this psukim carefully. So he says to them, who the people who are asking from him a king, this is how the law of the king works. Who will rule over you? You will take your sons. They're going to be his servants. They're going to run in front of his chariots. They're going to be his bellboys. They're going to do all his service. Number one. They're going to also be in his army. They're going to be in charge of many other people in his army. They're going to plow his fields and harvest his fields. They're going to work in the blacksmith shops to prepare his weaponry and his ammunition. And he's going to take your daughters and he's going to make them work in his kitchens. He's going to take your fields and he's going to give them to your servants, to his servants. He's going to take tithes. There's going to be taxes, folks. He's going to take taxes of your fields. And he's going to give them to your servants, to his officials and servants. You'll take your servants, your maid servants, your young and good children and animals. You'll take for his work. You'll take tithes of your animals, of your flocks. You'll be his servants at will. And on that day, you're going to call out. And you're going to say, this is unjust. And you're going to have marches in the square in the center of town against the Tsar. And God's not going to listen to you then. Why? Because you asked for him. You asked for this king. So before we get to this next point. So this is the end of Shmuel's speech. This is the Mishpat HaMelech. Is this what a king is, does? That's the question. What is Shmuel really saying?
A czar does it, not a king.
Okay, so is this regular kingship? Is this extreme kingship? What are we talking about over here? That's what we're talking about. It sounds like this is monarchy. Notice something very interesting over here. That in terms of the direction, in terms of the direction of service, which direction are we talking about? Everything a king gets. It's not about the king's. It's not about the king's giving, which is an important point. Because remember, even in a good old feudal system, right? You go back to, let's say, the feudal systems that operated in Western Europe, you know, in the good old days. So in the feudal systems, the king did all this, essentially, but he also protected the people. When his serfs were under attack by another knight or baron, he would go out there and he would fight them. So, interesting enough, Shmuel's not focusing on that, right? Shmuel obviously is giving a PR campaign to say, look at the things you're going to complain about. But there's actually a very fascinating debate about this exact story. Take a look in the sources for just a moment. There is a very interesting Gemara which is found in Sanhedrin. It's the very top of the next page. This is a Mishnah and a Gemara in Sanhedrin on Daf Chof and Aveis. So the Mishnah is talking about various things that kings are allowed to do. Here's how the Mishnah describes the very top of the page. A king can, if he can get permission from the court, he can go out to a milchemes rishus, an optional war, meaning it's not a mitzvah war. He does not defending Israel. He's not expanding the territories. He just decides that he wants to have a. He wants to. It's expansion of territories is not proper Israel. And if it so happens to be that your land is in the way that he decides he wants to go to war, he can go through your land and nobody can stop him, right? You happen to have fields along the coastal plain. You happen to have fields along the border. That's the way his army is going through. You know what happens when an army goes through your land? It ain't yielding too much corn that year, right? So that's where he can do that, right? Derech HaMelech ain lo shir, and the king's the amount of the king's way has no limit. And when there's a war and there's booty, he gets the first pick in the loot and without anybody forcing him. So this is what the Mishnah is saying. These are certain laws and parameters of king's rule. Now, the Gemara asks on our very text. Take a look at the very end of the first line on the top line on the left at the end. It says, Amar Rav Yehuda, Amar Shmuel. Rav Yehuda, Amar Shmuel says, Kolo Amor Baparshas Melech, Melech Mutar Boy. He says, anything which is said by Shmuel to the people right now is not just propaganda and bias. It really is the right of a king, if a king so chooses. However, Rav Omar, lo ne'emra parshazu, ela la'ayim aleihem. Rav says that this is not what a king is allowed to do. This is beyond the pale. This is not acceptable. But what he's doing is he's giving them, he's painting him the worst case scenario of a corrupt king, to show them, to scare them away from the prospect of kingship. Okay, so there's a debate in the Gemara over here, is what degree is this allowed? Is the Torah giving him, you know, free license to do anything he wants? Or no? No, no, no. He really has parameters, but this is what happens when it goes bad. And unfortunately, it went bad a lot of times. Right, still has. This is the debate in the Gemara about understanding this over here. Whichever way we look at it, we don't have the time to spend too much time getting into the real depths of this. Most of the Mepharshim on Tanakh say that this is extreme. Most of the Mepharshim, the Arba Brunel, the Radak, the Ralbag say that what Shmuel Davinavia is doing over here is Shmuel Anavi is giving them a propaganda campaign. You think the grass is so green? I want to tell you what it really looks like. I want to tell you what monarchy looks like when it goes bad. Shoftim may be bad too, but monarchy is also bad, like you're saying there. You know, it reminds me a little bit at the end of Animal Farm, and there's a line where George Orwell, and just to recap, Animal Farm is the book that George Orwell wrote about the ends of communism, and the animals take over the barn, they kick out the humans, and then slowly but surely, you know, there's a ruling class of animals, and the pigs take over, and ultimately speaking, at the end of the book, there's a line where it says that the animals looked from the pigs to the humans, and the humans to the pigs, and they couldn't tell the difference anymore. You know, and all things start off this ideally, and everybody's got these, you know, glitter in their eyes, and they're saying, well, let's bring in the king, and it'll be so much better than our current state policies. And Shmuel HaMelech is saying, just be careful. So before you start swallowing that pill, realize that not everything is as glittery as it looks on the other side. Okay, and that's how Shmuel paints in this picture. Is it a fair picture? It's not a full picture. The society, when it works in real concert, is a symphony, where there's two sides. The king protects, the king therefore also requests. But Shmuel is painting one side of this, which is a very sad side, and a true side of what really actually happens. We're not going to spend too much time on the specifics inside, just because for the sake of time. But we should notice that the interesting response of the people is the following. Let's look back in the Pesukim for just a brief moment. The Pesukim say, in your test, Vayamanu ha'am lishma b'kol Shmuel. Vayamer loy ki im melech ye'aleinu. They say no, they refused. They said, no, he'll be a good king to us. We're sure that ultimately speaking, he's going to lead by the moral standards that he was chosen for. He's going to judge us. He's going to war our wars. He's going to wage our wars. Everything will be just fine. And Shmuel then goes and says what the people's response was. Responds to Hashem. And the last words in the parak we have are the words where we don't know what the continuation is. But the Chof Beis says, Vayomer Hashem el Shmuel, Shma b'kolam, v'imlachto lachem elohem melech. They've chosen. Go find a king. Vayomer Shmuel el Anshei Yisrael, l'chu ish li'iroi. Return everybody. Isn't it interesting? Hashem doesn't respond. Hashem doesn't carry on the conversation. They've made their choice. They saw the potential. They said we want it. And they're going for it. What isn't clear over here is if they have modified their request somewhat, that becomes more acceptable in the way they rephrase it. Right? Meaning to say, what's happened is they said, no, we want a king, two, on that new list of two, A, B, C. Is that new A, B, C better than their first request? And that's why Hashem's listening to them? Or is Hashem and Shmuel, so to speak, thrown in the towel and say, this is what you want, this is what you're going to get? Okay, to the degree that question hinges upon a very important question, and that is to what degree is Shaul supposed to be, or potentially really, the chosen one of Hashem? To what degree is Shmuel has the potential of having longevity and having being a king? Or into what level does he start with a demerit? Not because of himself, but because of the vehicle with which he was asked for. Okay, so this is going to lay the grounds for that. What we stand to do next week is what was the real problem? I mean, what could be wrong about having a king? It's right, there's two systems of government at the time. One government isn't working so well, the other one also doesn't work so well. So what's the real problem? We're going to follow this through history, and we'll see, interestingly enough, that as we travel through the Mefarshim, we'll see that the Mefarshim are going to also inject their own personal relationships to kings. Most certainly we're going to see the Arba Ronel, who dealt with really bad kings, and how he tries to fit that with the Torah view of what a king is supposed to be. Okay, so that's our work next week. So looking forward, ladies, it's wonderful to be back at it. Next week will be at 8 o'clock. Okay?